Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors writing in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. The diva is a common trope when we talk about culture. We normally think of the diva as a Western construction. The opera singer, the Broadway actress, the movie star, a woman of outstanding talent whose personality and ability are both larger than life. But the truth is, throughout history, many cultures have featured spaces for strong female artists whose talent allows them to break free of the gender roles that pervaded their societies. In Three Asian Divas, Women, Art, and Culture in Shiraz, Delhi, and Yangzhou, David Chaffetz briefly explores how these Asian divas could be seen as some of the first recognizably modern women. After studying Persian, Turkish, and Arabic in college, David Chaffetz worked on the publication of the Encyclopedia Iranica and is also the author of A Journey Through Afghanistan, a study of its varied people, social classes, and religious sects. He has lived in Afghanistan, Iran, and Turkey and traveled extensively in Asia. After a 40-year break working in the technology industry, he returned to writing with Three Asian Divas. Today, David and I will talk about the three different cultures of Three Asian Divas: Shiraz, Delhi, and Yangzhou. We'll talk about what it means to be meant to be a diva in these historic contexts, and what they say about gender roles in 19th century Asia. So, David, perhaps the best place to start is to ask, what is a diva, and why write about them?
Yes, Nicholas, so you gave a good definition of the diva in the Western context, particularly in the modern usage, when we're talking about people like Maria Callas or Renee Fleming. But of course, that usage goes back to the beginning of the opera in Europe. It goes back to the Italian opera singers of the 17th and 18th century. But before then, people tended to call those women courtesans. And in Asia, in the literature referring to the women that I call divas, they're very often referred to as courtesans. And I wanted to avoid that word, because while it started off as a fairly prestigious nomenclature for the kind of talented women that you described, over time it came to mean simply a woman living from her charms. And it becomes detached from the concept of someone who is a great performer and a great artist, whereas the word diva retains those meanings. So I want to use the Western word diva to refer to the very talented courtesans of Asia, of India, Iran, and China, where I think it brings out what's really unique and specific about these women, whereas the word courtesan does not. What's interesting is that in the three languages of the book, Persian, Urdu, and Chinese, only the Chinese term literally means diva. I think mingjie in Chinese means renowned performer, which is exactly what a diva is. The other two words, in Persian, mogani, which means singer, and tawayef in Indian usage means member of a performing troupe, are not very prestigious or distinguished. So it's as though only the Chinese recognize that these women are really very special. And that comforts me in the use of the word diva.
I guess, do you have any theories why, I guess, how the term courtesan got applied to these different entertainers, and how that term perhaps got its slightly shadier connotations in recent years?
Well, that seems to be a general phenomenon in this line of business, if I may call it that. Because if you ask a young Chinese person today, what is a mingzhi, he will say, oh, it means prostitute. So even in contemporary Chinese, the word mingzhi has become devalued. That's partly because this line of business was always a little bit marginal from the conventional social values of all societies, from Europe to China. And that's something we probably should talk a little bit about. But it's also because over time, familiarity breeds contempt. And as the institution exists for a very long time, you have to keep on coming up with new words to indicate how these women who are very talented are different from women who are just sort of run-of-the-mill entertainers. So I think today we use the word diva because it's a relatively rich and exotic word, and it kind of keeps that focus on why these women are very extraordinary, whereas words, older words like courtesan have become, with time, very devalued.
So I'd like to kind of talk through the three examples of three Asian divas. First of all, the first one is Shiraz. So in the period we're talking about, what is Shiraz like? And what role do the Mogani play in Shiraz society?
Mm-hmm. So Shiraz, maybe not everybody knows, is still one of the very important cities in Iran. It's kind of a desert oasis city in the Zagros Mountains. It has been an important city for many, many centuries. But in the 14th century, which is the period that I focused on for this chapter in the book, it is a kind of oasis of peace, a little bit like Lisbon during World War II. There's warfare in many other parts of Iran because the descendants of Genghis Khan are trying to fight for control of Iran and land adjacent. And Shiraz has a series of rulers who stay out of all the messy fray, and they invite or they entice lots of poets and musicians and artists. And so it's a very happy place for the most part. And what we find is a play out of Iranian poets who more or less create the canon of classical Persian poetry at this time. One of the very few female poets, a woman named Malik Khatun, is also a contemporary of this period. So it's a very, very glorious period in Persian letters. We suspect it's also a very glorious period in music, although it's extremely difficult for us to construct the world of music in Iran before the 19th century. A lot of musical tradition had been lost, but from the ambiance, which is described in the poetry, you get the feeling that people spent a lot of time listening to music, musical concerts, and that in these musical concerts, there would have been singers and dancers, which in Persian are called Mogani. Now, what was the role of the Moganis? What was the role of the divas? I just take you to the curious fact that the greatest Persian poet, Hafez, performed in Shiraz in this period around 1400. And within a few years of his performing in Shiraz, his poetry was famous all over the world where Persian was spoken, in Gujarat, in India. One of the sultans invited Hafez to come visit him. So you ask yourself, how did Hafez's poetry get recited in Gujarat just a couple of years after he wrote it in Shiraz? And I think the answer is that the Moganis traveled, and they were a little bit like Spotify. They popularized famous poems and made them known to cultivated audiences all over the world, the Persian-speaking world. I really don't think that it was manuscripts that traveled, because it takes time to write a manuscript. You can only have a few number of manuscripts at any period of time. And really importantly is that poetry is an oral form. And I don't see the Sultan of Gujarat sitting around reading manuscripts of poetry, whereas he would have had singing girls performing for him. So I this was sort of the clue to me that there is a phenomenon here that the singing girls of Shiraz, the Mogani, were a really critical institution for popularizing the classics, what become the classics, for diffusing them across the Persian-speaking world, and for sort of shifting out which of the many talented poets of Shiraz would become the most famous poets in the Persian canon. And I think that's the role that the Mughani play. And I look for evidence of the similar role in India and China. And I think that confirms that this is one of the most important aspects of one of the most important roles they play in history.
I would like to move on to talking about Indian Delhi, but before we do that, I'd like a pronunciation check on my part. So the Mughani are in Shiraz, and it's the Tawaif in Delhi, or is that the?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I've got the pronunciation right. Excellent. Yes, well, as best as one can. But let's move on to India and kind of, first of all, I guess what was Delhi like at this period of time? And I think you've already said that the Tawaif, you think, plays a similar role in Delhi, but maybe you can just go into that a little bit in the Indian context.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things. I need to say something for the listeners that I picked three different performances, right? Shiraz, Delhi, Hangzhou, and they are three different periods in history. The phenomenon of the divas, the importance of the divas fills a pretty broad historical stage from let's say from Han Dynasty China, let's say 100 AD up until the beginning of the 19th century. So I've simply picked three examples at different points in time. So Shiraz was 14th century. In India, we skip to the 1840s. Not that I could not have found a similar example in the 15th century, but it's just the luck of the draw was it was a more interesting opportunity to talk about India at Delhi at the end of the Mughal Empire on the eve of this very tragic event, which the Indians refer to as the First Indian War of Independence, and which the British used to refer to as the Indian Mutiny. So Delhi in the 1840s was having a cultural comeback. It had been sacked several times by the Persians, the Afghans, and the Marathas, and all the poets, patrons, and singers had scurried off to Lucknow and Hyderabad and other formerly provincial capitals. But under the last Mughal emperor, Bahadur Shah, Delhi was having a cultural comeback and was beginning to gather in men of letters, very importantly, musicians, and a flourishing Tawaif culture. Because we're talking about a much closer historical period now, 1840, we know a lot more about this period. There's much more documentation. And very importantly, I mentioned how in Shiraz, we suspect music was very important, but we don't actually have the music. In this case, from the 1840s, we have musical manuscripts. We have traditions of music coming down to us that was taught from teacher to student in an unbroken chain from this period of time. And so we have a very good idea what kind of singing was done and how the Tawaif in particular took poetry and vehiculated it, let's say, vehiculated the poetry through song and music, which I think is a really important point for trying to appreciate and understand Persian or Urdu poetry. So and we know a lot more about the Tawaifs of the 1840s because that institution survived in one form or another up to the beginning of the 20th century. So we know how they were taught, to write and to recite poetry, to sing, to dance. They were taught the arts of polite conversation. They were taught how to handle very, important people, princes, kings, generals, They even entertained the leading British officials of the East India Company, and we have reports of British visitors to Tawaf performances and how the British appreciated more or less what they were hearing. Of course, in those days, many of the British spoke Persian and Urdu, and some of them even composed poetry in Persian and Urdu. So there was a lot more international appreciation of this art than there probably is now. So that gives you a picture of Delhi in this period. And if I was going to say, is there a difference between the Tawaifs in this 19th century Indian framework and the 14th century Iranian framework, I would say the Tawaifs are part of a much, much older tradition in India that goes back to classical Sanskrit theater, where they play almost the role of sort of sacerdotal courtesans. And of course you have the Devi Dasi in India, which is a sacerdotal courtesan exactly. And I think that creates a somewhat special aura around these women, as opposed to Iran, where I think there was never any religious or quasi-religious aspect to them, and it always was simply a form of very elevated entertainment.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So we should probably, before we talk about all three of these divas in general, we have to end with Yangzhou, which is the third city you talk about in Three Asian Divas. So in the period we're talking about, which I believe is the Ming Dynasty, what's that city and society like? And finally, who are the Mingji, and I guess in some ways, how are they similar and how are they different from the Mogani and the Tawaif?
Yeah. So for the non-Chinese listeners, Yangzhou is a city on the Yangtze River, sort of midway up, I guess you could say. It is still, but in those days, it was a very wealthy city. It was given a monopoly on salt in the entire Ming Empire. So this created a coterie of very wealthy merchants who attracted literary people for entertainment or for business. And because it was not a capital, it wasn't Nanjing, the intellectual and political environment in the city was much freer than that of an official capital. And as a result, they developed a very laid back kind of vibe, which was where people would come from all over the country to make their name in performance. So I'd use the analogy, it was a little bit like Hollywood in the 1930s. The institution of Mingjie, the renowned performers, we know in China dates back to the Han Dynasty and possibly earlier. But what's interesting is that when we see them at the beginning of Chinese history, they work for the state. The state has a ministry called the Ministry of Merriment, and the Mingzi are employees. So whenever the emperor gives a big feast or there's a holiday, these women are deployed to perform entertainment. And it's a little bit like, the last Olympic Games in Beijing. You have these fabulous spectacles being put on by the Chinese state. And I think the Chinese state has always had that capability. What happened is over time, as society became richer and a little bit more bourgeois, particularly under the Song Dynasty, the Mingzis got their freedom from the state and started to operate on their own. And it was a fairly big business, and it was a female-run business. And they branched out into putting on opera, putting on public performances, when these were not banned on the basis of protecting public morals. And this made them extremely wealthy. So if I want to contrast the Chinese Mingzi with the Indian Taoists, I would say that the Chinese Mingzi had the ability to project themselves on a wider, in a more public format. And that's why we see them as theatrical entrepreneurs, as stage managers, as dramatists, and they essentially create one of the earlier forms of what we would call Chinese opera, which is the Kungqu opera. So it just had, as many things do in China compared to the rest of the world, bigger scale. And in that respect, I think they had a bigger impact on public culture than the Taoists, who always played privately.
So in Three Asian Divas, it argues that you could see these entertainers as some of the first recognizably modern women. And I'd like to delve a bit deeper into that. In what ways do the Mogani, the Tawaif, and the Mingzi, do they act as predecessors to our modern ideas of gender and gender roles?
Yeah, well, it's always a little bit problematic to try to understand gender roles in the past. And there's a danger of obviously of seeing things through our own lens or either seeing the past as being very benighted, and of course we're much more enlightened, or seeing the past as being just an extension of our own views. But I would argue that traditional world, pre-19th century in most of the world, people pretty much did not have agency. Even the wealthy, even the nobles, were locked in a very rigid rigid set of expectations in terms of their obligations and their privileges vis-a-vis other people in society. And you don't find a lot of agency. Even Bahadur Shah, emperor of the Mughals, sitting in Delhi, was basically a prisoner in the palace. And of course, he ended very badly because he was manipulated into supporting the revolution against the British. So how much agency did he really have? But I think creative people, people who compose music, who compose poetry, who perform poetry, there is just something very free about that. And, getting up on the stage in front of a bunch of people and debuting a new poem or a new song, which becomes a hit, which becomes part of the classics which people will be reciting for generations thereafter, that's a very powerful source of agency. So I attribute a lot of agency to these women in the three cultures we talk about. A couple other things. They also enjoyed, it has to be remembered, a very thorough education. If we talk about the Chinese for a second, these women would have read the Chinese classics. They would have mastered the various genres of Chinese poetry. One of them very well known, published a compendium of Tang Dynasty poetry. This is in the Ming Dynasty period. So they were very well educated. And of course, that kind of education tends to give you a sense of empowerment and a sense of enlightenment, which is rare among anybody in those days, let alone among women. And then finally, they had a certain amount of power because they were wealthy and they had amazing social capital because they frequented the most powerful people in their societies. And they could use their power for better or worse on behalf of their own agendas. So the agency, the level of education, and their social power all makes them very different from other people of the period, and particularly other women. And if we think about what women are trying to assert in our society, which is they can be as powerful as men, or they are as powerful as men, they should not feel that they're not entitled to asserting that power, then I think women could look at the Mingji or the Taoyuan of previous years and say these women, they had it all.
You know, one thing the book notes is that all three, the Mogani, the Taoyuan, and the Mingji, were free to, quote, love whom they wished. Did these historical societies have the same, for lack of a better word, let's call them sexual hang-ups as their Western counterparts? Were these hang-ups expressed differently? And I guess importantly, how were these three classmate retainers able to break free of those strictures?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Again, it's very hard to know exactly what people thought about love and sex in the past, just as it's hard to know what they think about it now. There, in some fundamental level, European and Asian relations between men and women have never been fundamentally different. So you have to be careful to try to think that there's any big difference in the way they thought about these things. But if I could point to one distinguishing factor between Asia and Europe. In fact, it's probably the thing that makes Asia and Europe the most different is the institution of marriage and the social segregation of sexes. In all three countries that we're talking about here, Iran, India, and China, there is polygamy and there is purdah, that is to say, social separation of the sexes. So the women live in a parallel universe. They're not integrated into society the way they are in Western society in any historical period until the 19th century. So that seems very harsh, but it also gives them a tremendous amount of freedom because they operate within their own rules in a universe which they completely control. I give you an example of the difference between Asia and Europe in that respect. Here in Portugal, we have the famous opera singer, Elizabeth Todi, who was a great diva of the late 18th century and traveled all over Europe giving performances. But here in Portugal, she was never allowed to perform in public. She could only perform privately in the court because the state felt that a woman performing in public was a bad thing and shouldn't be permitted. In India or in China, that would have been people would have said, "Well, of course she performs in public, but I would never go. But I would never go there with my wife. My wife is in purdah." So the fact that you have this very strong segregation between the male space and the female space means that the diva can perform for males, exclusively for males, really. And there's no afterthoughts. There's no regrets. There's no concern that she might undermine the social order. Whereas in Europe, the fear was these women could undermine the social order. So in that respect, the greater lack of freedom of women in general gave the divas, in some sense, more freedom.
So I had one question about your thought process behind writing the book. You've structured the book around three, let's call them reconstructed performances. Why did you make that stylistic choice in writing three Asian divas?
Yes. So each of the chapters takes one of the venues and one of the singers and sort of takes the reader through a performance. I believe that for most of our history, the way we have appreciated poetry has been spoken or sung. It is a relatively recent phenomenon for people to read poetry in a book. And I, in particularly with respect to some of the poems that I use in the book, when I read the poems, of course, I read them, I didn't sing them, I was really struck by how song-like they are. And I wanted to experience them as song. In the case of the Chinese and the Indian poems, because we're not talking about a historical period too far away, I'm able to find them on YouTube or somewhere as performances. In the case of the Iranian poem, I found all these modern performances, but I didn't think that they were very accurate. So I did some research to try to find out how they might have been performed in the traditional sense. And I think I want people to appreciate poetry as a musical entertainment and realize that a lot of the buzz around these poems comes from the fact that they were once performed so memorably as live performances that the reason why they're in our school books, the reason why they are considered part of the canon, is because the original performance was such a hit. And indeed, I have some Chinese commentators from the 16th, 17th century saying that the main reason why these poems are so successful is because so-and-so sang them at such and such a time. So you really see even the contemporaries realize that the performances were critical to the success of these poems.
So I had one final question about three Asian divas. Are any of these art forms, these performances in three Asian divas, are they still present today? Or have they influenced more contemporary art forms? I note the irony that you mentioned in Three Asian Divas that poets of the time in India were most proud of their work in Persian, but it's their work in Urdu that has survived to the present day.
Yeah, because over time the Indians have stopped learning Persian as a important language for them, and so of course the Urdu poems Urdu Hindi poems are obviously more popular. They're still more or less understandable by people today. So let's say in Iran, the problem is that although there was a great revival of singing poetry in the 20th century, today women are not allowed to perform in public or not allowed to perform music in Iran. So the tradition of female singers in Iran is in suspension for the moment. There is a great enthusiasm for performing classical Iranian poetry set to music. There are many composers. There's a great musician named Shadiani who just died, who's considered to be one of the great interpreters of Persian poetry in a musical form. But again, they are men, and it become a very male dominated genre in Iran anyway. In India, what has happened is that the musical families, the musical traditions that once performed with and for the Tawayefs, eventually made it to Bollywood. If you notice in Bollywood film credits, how many of the musicians and singers are Muslims? It's because the Tawayef class really survived in Bollywood and thrived in Bollywood by translating themselves into modern movie actors, singers, dancers, and composers. So what's happened is it becomes, of course, quite dumbed down. Some of the great classical singers were asked to make their songs more pop, and they resisted. But now it's become terribly pop, and the tradition of singing that kind of music has really faded. And the people my age, and I'm in my 60s, they will still have favorite singers from the 1950s who sang pretty much classical Urdu poetry in the proper form to the appropriate music. But I suspect that the younger generation is not so interested in that anymore. In China, there has been a big revival of the Kung Chu opera form, particularly recognizing the fact that it was an opera form invented by women or popularized by women. So there are in Shanghai some troupes which are all women that perform all the roles. And it's sort of hanging in there. Of course, it has a lot of state support, as opera does all over the world. But you can't really see it as a flourishing art form. And I think the general view is it's not doing that well because it is not that popular or that accessible, but you do have some aficionados. So in a way, it's no worse off than opera in the Western world, but it's an opera of repertory, of course. It's no longer an opera of creation. So that gives you a survey of where this art form is. It's like many high art forms. It requires so much training on the part of the performers and so much implicit knowledge on the part of the audience that it's often hard to sustain that kind of art over a long period of time with a modern audience.
So with that ends our interview with David Chaffetz, author of Three Asian Divas, Women, Art, and Culture in Shiraz, Delhi, and Yangzhou. One final question, David. Where can people find your work, and what's your next project?
Oh, well, they can find my work on Amazon. If they're in Hong Kong, they can find it at the Foreign Correspondents Club. And I'm in the middle of writing a much, much longer, quite complicated book about the vital role of horses in Asian history. Thanks for asking.
I guess how far along are you with that project, or have you only just started?
I've written about 150,000 words, and now I need to pare it down.
Oh, so you're in that stage of the project. Well, you can follow me, you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. Thanks again so much, David, for joining me today.
Thanks, Nicholas. Have a good day.